This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 156 was recorded on February 28, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Dr. Pippa Malmgren is one of my personal all-time favorite guests, and she's back this week for what has to be her best Macro Voices interview to date. We'll discuss everything from U.S.-China trade negotiations to the rise of populism around the globe to the developing trend of surveillance capitalism. This interview ran a little longer than usual, so we'll have an abbreviated postgame segment this week. And a quick housekeeping note. We'll be releasing Macro Voices a day early next week on Wednesday evening, March 6th, in order to accommodate travel schedules. We're working hard to find credible stock market bulls to offset the bears that we've had on the program in recent weeks. So my guest next week will be Barry Ritholtz, chairman and CIO of Ritholtz Wealth Management and host of Bloomberg's Masters in Business podcast. And I assure you, Barry will give you a very bullish view with plenty of frickin' New York vocabulary thrown in to make his points. So be sure to tune in next Wednesday evening for that interview.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into the S&P 500. We just tested those November and October highs that were all around that 2810 area on the upside, and we're stalling here. Is this all the S&P's got left in the tank here, or is there another leg still coming?
Well, as I've said many times, I think the bear market has begun. This is a bear market rally, but boy, it's been a hell of an exuberant bear market rally. 2812 on the S&P was the second to last line in the sand, as I see it. The last one's at 2877. If we break above that, then it really points to new all-time highs. And I will be astonished, as I said I would be, but won't be the first time I was proven wrong. We need to look at that possibility seriously. But frankly, you know, I think there's plenty of room for this to be it. 2812 was a key fib level. It was rejected very vigorously. So far, at least, we're seeing the market trading off of that. Now, Charlie McElligott at Nomura has been describing an Ides of March sequencing, where we would see a melt up in stock prices going into the quad witching day on the 15th of March. But the scenario Charlie has described is that there would be a sell-off coming out of March 15th, and that could potentially violate a number of key levels in the evolving CTA model and really cause a dramatic sell-off to ensue. Now, needless to say, these prognostications several weeks in advance are never perfect. Charlie's views, I'm sure, will evolve over time. We're going to try to get more commentary and more perspective on that particular scenario and keep you updated on it between now and the 15th of March. Per last week's commentary, I did buy June put spreads, 2750 to 2500 put spreads. But frankly, Patrick, I really don't like the risk reward there. I'm paying $45. These things are only good till June. If I want the same trade out to December, it's a $60 premium. So I decided, and maybe this is just my nature as more of an outright futures trader than an options trader, I went short off of that 2812 fib level with outright futures and a stop well below the, you know, if I had bought the options again, I would have paid either $45 or $60 to buy options in option premia. I'd rather have a $45 range to give my trade a little bit of room to run before I stop myself out. And to me, that's a better risk reward scenario than buying the options at these prices. So we'll see what happens. If we break seriously past 2812, I think we're headed to 2877. Now, there's a caveat there, which is this Ides of March scenario that Charlie has described seems to me like a perfect setup to trick the market where we do go past 2812 because that's a key Fibonacci level, that leads to more buying begets more buying. Maybe we see a push up to 28.25, 28.30 or something before that Ides of March scenario kicks in and we come back down. But Patrick, if we go past the 15th of March and we're still well above 28.12, then I think we're headed to 28.77. And if it doesn't stop there, we're going to new all-time highs. Makes absolutely no sense to me for that to happen. I will be astonished if that happens, but that doesn't mean it can't happen. We've taken our listener requests very seriously to get credible bulls on the program in order to counterbalance the many bears we've had. Pippa is going to give us a fantastic interview today. She's bullish on the market long term. Barry Ritholtz coming up next week, also bullish. So we're taking your message to heart, folks, when you've asked us to balance the bears that we've had on the program recently. We need to start talking about double tops and fresh highs and what that signal would mean and how traders should react to it, because as much as I assure you that I will be astonished if it happens, it doesn't mean it can't happen.
All right. Well, let's move on to the dollar index. And it's obviously continues that multi-week pullback. We continue to seem to hold this 96 handle pretty well. Are you still bullish in this narrative here? Or what's your thinking here on the dollar?
Well, Patrick, clearly we are in a pullback, but so what? All healthy bull markets have pullbacks in them. We haven't moved to a new lower low. We're still above January's lows. And if I look at the tape action in the last day or two, it almost looks like we're starting maybe to see signs of bottoming here. So if this pullback continues, we take out the January lows and we really, you know, drop off a cliff down to 94 or something, it's time to reevaluate my view. But as I see this, it's a perfectly normal pullback in a healthy bull market rally.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because just a few days ago, we got that big slam down in crude that looked like it was going to roll over and begin some sort of sell cycle, but the bulls came right back and bought it right back to the one-month high. What's your thinking here? Does oil still have gas in the tank to go higher?
Well, Patrick, it has been a real roller coaster. First big part of the story on Monday morning was President Trump's tweet. As somebody on Twitter put it, oil prices have moved back into the tweet zone. So that tweet panicked everybody. To me, it's evidence of the fragility in the market. Now, I don't think the tweet had the effect that the president intended. It didn't intimidate Saudi Arabia the way he might have hoped it would have. But it shocked the market dramatically lower. We got a test of the 13-day moving average, and you know, it seemed like the sky was falling. But then, Patrick, on Wednesday, when we got inventory, that was really the story of the week in crude oil. Now, folks, remember, we're in restocking season, which means builds on inventory are expected. Drawdowns are unusual this time of year. We didn't just get a drawdown. We got an 8.6 million barrel drawdown. That is utterly massive. I don't have exact statistics in front of me, but it's on the, you know, 20-year flood kind of level in terms of how exceptional that event would be. There have been bigger monthly draws than 8.6 million barrels in the last 20 years, but for this particular week of the year, as we're coming into end of February, beginning of March, shoulder season, when we should be restocking, it really was an epic build. You could not ask for a more bullish inventory number. Meanwhile, gasoline and distillates both drawing down as well. Gasoline drawing down 1.9 million barrels, distillates drawing down 604,000 barrels. Now, Cushing, Oklahoma, which is the settlement point for the WTI crude oil contract, building 1.6 million barrels. Kind of curious, almost feels like a trend is beginning. For the last 3 weeks, we've seen very significant Cushing builds, even in the face of drawdowns on a national level. So I'm not quite sure what's happening there. But Patrick, this should have been, and I think it could arguably be described as the most bullish inventory report in years for this time of year. And what happened? The market pulsed modestly higher, but then it struggled for several minutes just to break through the high of the day and the 100-day moving average, which shouldn't really have been that significant of resistance considering how profoundly bullish the inventory numbers were. And then it still never managed to retrace back to Monday's pre-tweet high. So what this says to me, Patrick, is if in the face of this just incredibly bullish inventory data that surprised everyone, we still can't get to a new high on the week. That tells me that this market is really, really tired here. So to me, it's just more confirmation that the market is in a topping process. Production ticked up to yet another all-time new record, 12.1 million barrels. As I've been saying for many weeks, the market is oversupplied with oil and getting more oversupplied. Exports also, it wasn't quite a new record. Last week's number of 3.6 million barrels per day is still the all-time record, but at 3.3 million barrels, this is the first time in history that we've had two consecutive weeks in a row over 3 million barrels. So that's another 23 million barrels of oil that was exported from the United States in the past week. Maybe that's why the draw on inventory was discounted, was because if that 23 million barrels had not been exported, it would have been a build. It certainly, all of this emboldens my conviction, Patrick, that this market is pretty darn close to topping out. Now, there's plenty of room for one last push higher. You know, Fridays are usually up days in crude oil. At the close today, RBOB gasoline, which oftentimes is the early tell for what crude oil is going to do next, it tried to push down and test its five-day moving average just before the close, but it ended up above the five, above the eight, and even above the 100-day moving average by the 2:30 close. So it looks to me like maybe there's room for one last push higher. 58.20 would be the upside target. That's the top of the broadening wedge pattern. Very possible Fridays are often an up day. But frankly, I'll be very surprised if we go any higher than 58.20, and I won't be at all surprised if we don't go higher at all and if we end up just topping out here and moving lower. One way or another, I think we're getting close to the end of this rally, and I think there's plenty of room to the downside. The Trump tweet has worn off. Today, we had news of a SPR release, Strategic Petroleum Reserve sale. That release will occur in the month of May to coincide with Iran sanction waivers. So what's Donald Trump's next move going to be? History shows us that the first Trump oil tweet has never been the last Trump oil tweet. So I don't think we're done here seeing the president try to push the market lower. And it remains to be seen how aggressive Saudi Arabia will be in reaction to that. Downside target, immediate downside target would be low 53 handle initially. That would be the bottom of the broadening wedge pattern that's forming on this chart. If we were to see a daily close below that, suddenly the high 40 handles start to come back into view.
So let's move on and talk about gold, because last week, right as we were recording the show, we were talking about gold kissing that 1350 overhead resistance level. And since then, over the last five trading sessions, we've seen gold really start to give a lot back. We're now at the time of recording around this $1,314 level. What's your thinking here on gold? Is that a major overhead resistance that's going to fail this year?
Well, not only are we down, Patrick, but, you know, I've acknowledged on past shows that there have been up days where gold and the dollar index were both moving up at the same time, which is very much inconsistent with historical norms. Well, now we need to acknowledge down days, because we've had several days this week where gold and the dollar moved down at the same time together on the same day. So gold is retreating from that key 1350 resistance level, and that's been a very hard resistance level for like 5 years now, even as the dollar weakens rather dramatically over the last 3 days. That has still not helped gold, even though you would normally expect it to. So there could be more downside to come, especially if the dollar rebounds, which would normally be gold bearish. There's also room, though, to conclude that this whole correlation between the dollar and gold has simply broken down completely. It's not happening. But I do have to revisit the pairs trade that I've described before in this program, long gold and long the dollar index at the same time. Now, Patrick, my whole thesis for that trade has been that I can describe a macro argument for why gold and the dollar could go up together at the same time, or why they might go back to their historical norm of trading inversely. But I have opined in the past that I can't see any way or any rationale for why they would both trend lower at the same time, where both the dollar and gold are moving down together, which would be the lose-lose for the pairs trade that I've described. Well, that's exactly what's happened for the last 3 days. Now, 3 days is not a trend, but this does raise a significant yellow flag for that pairs trade. I want to see whether or not there's a possibility that gold and the dollar can both trade down together, because that certainly nixes my pairs trade if that is possible, although I certainly cannot articulate a macro argument for why that would continue beyond a very short time horizon. So let's see how this develops. Daily closes above 1350 or below 1304 are the next really important signals to watch for. If we see a breakout above 1350, especially one that is sustained and that gets upside momentum moving quickly above 1350, you want to jump on that. But I think there's still a possibility that we could have seen a test of that key resistance level that maybe is setting us up for a significant and protracted move down before eventually gold has its day in the sun. We'll see what happens.
All right. Well, let's touch on those 10-year treasury yields. We seem to be going to about a two-week high here as the yields are pressing a 272 here as at the time of the recording. We're off of the lows. Is this a new breakout in yields?
I don't think so. We're, what, 3 basis points higher in yield than last week, and we're still right in the middle of that 2.60 to 2.80 trading range. I really don't see anything new here. If we're headed into recession, which I think we are, then that should bring lower yields. We'll see what happens. In general, though, I should just confess that I really don't pay a whole lot of attention, and I don't have a whole lot of conviction about the direction of this market, because trading this right here doesn't appeal to me. What's appealing to me is the really big short on treasuries. I think the negative yielding sovereign debt around the world has been absolutely crazy. And I think if we go to a recession and we get maybe back to another test of that 1.34 10-year yield, we're setting up at some point in the future for an epic shorting opportunity in fixed income. And it'll be both in treasuries and particularly in junk-rated debt. But I don't think that day is here yet. And in the meantime, I'm just on the sidelines watching, seeing what's happening.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is Dr. Pippa Malmgren. Eric, please share with our listeners why we invited Pippa back as this week's featured interview guest.
Well, aside from being just one of my favorite people anywhere, Pippa has been an advisor to 2 U.S. presidents. Her dad advised 4 presidents during his career. So this is a person who grew up in a family that advises U.S. presidents on geopolitics as well as economics. She has an outstanding track record. She was a member of the President's Working Committee on Financial Markets, what some people colloquially call the plunge protection team, although in her past interviews, she's debunked that reputation a little bit. And we're frankly long overdue on this program for a thorough analysis of the many geopolitical factors that are affecting markets. And again, Patrick, as I said in the beginning, she's just one of our all-time favorite guests, and she's a listener favorite as well. So it's really great to have her back. And in my opinion, this was Pippa's best Macro Voices interview to date.
Well, Eric's interview with Dr. Pippa Malmgren is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Returning as this week's feature interview guest is Dr. Pippa Malmgren, one of our all-time favorite guests on this program. Pippa, thanks so much for being with us this week. You know, I got to ask you, as a geopolitical expert, what do you think is going on at this point, and how should investors understand this whole Trump-Xi situation? Because as I understand it, the way it comes across to me is everything was rosy until October. All fourth quarter of last year, we saw 20%, more than 20% down on the S&P, mostly driven by fear of trade war. Now, maybe we're on the way and we're seeing this huge bounce and it's all recovering. So it seems like this massive market swing has been driven largely by this. And now I think the message from President Trump is it's absolutely hardline. We're not going to negotiate. But oh, by the way, the weather's nice at Mar-a-Lago this time of year, so we should do beers. I'm having trouble interpreting what's going on here. Where do you think this is headed and what does it mean?
I hear you. Yeah, I think everybody's having trouble. And one of the reasons is because both Xi Jinping and President Trump are negotiating in a way that's very typical for businesses, not very typical for governments. So usually government assigns people from the Pentagon to go discuss something like the normalization of relations on the Korean Peninsula, the potential removal of U.S. troops from 38th parallel there, that kind of thing. And separately, you would have your trade negotiators from the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, and they would go talk about trade issues with China. What we have here is all of these things are thrown onto the table simultaneously and are part of one big negotiation. And I would say that includes normalization and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, the question of the South China Sea, the trade disputes, and the Huawei question, which is, you know, how much latitude should the Americans give Chinese tech companies who the Americans view as surveillance enterprises that are serving a public function. They're serving the state's interests. And by the way, the Chinese take exactly the same view of Google, Facebook, Amazon, that these are all part of the state apparatus, which is why they've banned them in China. Now, there are more, but these are the core issues that they have both put onto the table. So notice the timing. As soon as there's some progress on the Korean question, this is when Trump says, we don't have to be so tough. We can postpone the implementation of new tariffs and duties on Chinese goods by a couple of months. Everybody goes, wait a minute. I thought things weren't going well in the trade talks. How come now he's making concessions? It's because it has nothing to do with the trade talks. He's offering something in exchange for progress on the Korean Peninsula question. Trade is just an instrument, a tool in that negotiation process. So if we step back and stop looking at it from the narrow perspective that we've been trained to do, and instead step back and say, what we have here is a property guy who wants a win. And we've got a leader of a nation who sees a one moment in history opportunity to settle a whole bunch of issues with the United States with a president who wants to do a deal. This is a rare set of circumstances. The next president is not going to think like this. They're not going to put everything on the table at once. And they aren't desperate to have some cool deal they can announce that, by the way, potentially involves a Nobel Peace Prize being awarded, maybe not to Xi and Trump, but to the leaders of North and South Korea. And you can be sure that those two guys will be standing in the back of the frame, you know, photobombing it, basically. So I think what's happening is there is progress on the Korean Peninsula issue. And as a result, there will be a diminution of the stress over trade. And what I expect is sometime in the next couple of years, before Trump leaves office, we will get a comprehensive deal. All of a sudden, we will have the North and the South not reunified, but normalized. We will find the nuclear issue is addressed. There'll be a high degree of confidence that China will take responsibility to make sure it doesn't come back to bite the world at a later date. China effectively will be permitted by the United States to soft annex North Korea, which, by the way, everybody's delighted about because they can take responsibility for this very tricky population and basically bring them into the world economy. China wants it because it's the last pool of cheap labor left on the planet. I think there'll be part of this will be something about the South China Sea, acknowledging China's right to be present there, but equally China acknowledging there's a need to protect the freedom of passage, and they'll come to some accommodation. And when the market registers that there is some kind of comprehensive deal that permits the shaking of hands and some photo opportunities, and that for the time being, the stress will have been relieved, you can be sure the markets are going to go right up on that. Stock markets are going to love that, right? Everywhere, markets are going to love that. And then we can get into what happens next, the next president, the next set of circumstances. But what I think these two people are looking for is that kind of comprehensive deal. And the market's watching the details and missing the bigger picture here.
So let me make sure that I understand correctly. To summarize your view of the bigger picture, all of this trade talk, which basically tanked the stock market 20%, and now we've retraced most of that, you think it was a red herring, that really this is a much broader thing, and that all of the trade talk is going to be forgotten about, everything's going to be patched over once we come to terms on some broader agreement? Is that it? Or is it more of the trade really lays in the balance with these other things, and we might not come to the right agreement, and the trade situation might get much worse than people think?
It's neither. It's not the trade's a red herring. These are real issues. And certainly as far as the president is concerned, they're very, very real issues. It's just that trade is one tool in a toolbox of ways to influence the outcome. And if you ask, what's the most important historic outcome? What would be the biggest victory that both these parties are looking for? Would that be the announcement that the United States and China were no longer in trade disputes? That's a good announcement. I mean, as a former presidential advisor, I'd say that's a nice announcement. That'll get you some headlines for a day or two. That's good. If you announce that you are normalizing the relations on the Korean Peninsula and effectively removing the nuclear threat to the world, yeah, that goes in the Wikipedia entry. That's a huge historic event that those two leaders will be famous for forever. So if I can do both at once, if I can sort the nuclear issue and get a resolution on the trade stuff, now that's like your ultimate cool victory. I mean, and from a Chinese point of view, if they can get the South China Sea thrown into the mix, which is a subject that most Americans don't know about, don't particularly understand, wouldn't really get, so Trump can negotiate that away a little bit without anybody criticizing him. And then it's win all around. But, you know, let's be clear. The markets think the most important thing is an announcement on trade. And they don't really care about the Korean Peninsula and history. But markets, you know, I always say perception is everything. And when I worked on trading floors, if we imagine that there's a theater and standing on the stage is the president in the Oval Office, who is in the audience? Well, the traders and the market people, they think that they are in the front row. They are the most important thing that matters. And the general public, they're way at the back, right? But when you work in the White House, no, it's the opposite. The general public is in the front row. And way off somewhere in the corner, dark corner, where you can't even see them, are these trader people. And they make a lot of noise from time to time. You don't really know what they're on about. Like, why are they driven by some things and not others? They're sort of important because they seem to drive the bond market. But they are not your principal focus if you're the president of the United States. That's a sideline. So that's why the market thinks their issue is the most important one, resolution of the trade conflict. But the White House, and not just this one, but any White House would say, resolution of the Korean Peninsula, now that is historic.
Now, you mentioned most people don't understand the Spratly Islands and the South China Sea and so forth. Why don't we quickly get your overview of what the significance is of that? What is going on there? Why is it important and who is it important to?
Well, it's part of a big strategy that China has to take greater control over the supply lines in and out of China. Now, they're doing it lots of different ways. There's this thing called the Belt and Road Initiative that now most people are familiar with, which is the building of truly historic infrastructure, airports, ports, railways, roads, digital infrastructure for the transportation of data, but also things like aqueducts to move water from the Himalayas into China and irrigate the West as if it could be a California. It's a very broad, comprehensive view that they're expressing that China needs to be more connected to the rest of the world in order to secure stability. That's what they're focused on. Now, one part of that picture is the South China Sea. And so the Spratlys, all these island chains that basically were a bunch of rocks sticking out of the Pacific Ocean. But legally, once the Chinese started to put concrete on them and particularly elevate them with concrete, because under the law of the sea, the elevation is everything. once they started to physically reinforce them, then their ability to claim ownership over them went up dramatically. And in the last few years, what they've been doing is building runways and airstrips and docking facilities, ports type facilities, which further increases their foothold. Now, why do they want it? Well, it's part of this security of supply. It's partly that they view that this part of the world is effectively their backyard, and they wanted some way of standing off against the United States and preventing the U.S. from encroaching on China. And let's not forget, I know it's a fact I'm always pointing out for people, but, you know, this is a country, China is a country that cannot feed itself. It does not have enough arable land, enough clean water. And so how are you going to feed all these people? Well, it turns out that 10% of the world's fish supply is right there in the South China Sea. So part of establishing a physical presence is to secure that supply chain of protein. I think it's bigger than that as well. China's extending its reach, pushing out the borders and boundaries to become more interconnected with the world. And they do it one direction with the Belt and Road, and the other direction they're doing it with a maritime strategy. But taken together, that's the way I see it. It's a comprehensive approach, which Xi Jinping decided and announced in very early days, about 2013. So they've had a view on this for a very long time.
So big picture, what you think is really going on, which investors need to understand, is Trump is really looking for the big political win. It's not just about trade negotiation. It's about this all-encompassing deal that brings together the conflict in the South China Sea, the elimination, hopefully, of the nuclear threat on the Korean Peninsula. Trade is part of it. Now, I'm just thinking about this as you're describing it. Is President Trump's strategy here to sort of time this so that he gets this really grand big win right around election time in order to cement his reelection?
So I have a very out of the market view on this. I think, yes, the total focus for the White House and for the Chinese is to announce this big comprehensive deal that covers a lot of subjects at once. And the two leaders go down in history over the Korean stuff, but they also basically get to go down as, you know, that moment where there was a big fight and in the end they settled all the disputes. That's a great victory for both of them. And it would set the stage for at least a decade, maybe two decades of more normalized relations. But what is the president's personal agenda? My view is I think the chances are that he is not going to run again. And that is a function of, well, it's a number of things. One, remember, the reason he ran for the presidency was because he was intending to launch what they're calling TNN, which is the Trump News Network, which would challenge CNN. And notice that in recent months, he's often spoken or tweeted about the need for CNN to have a competitor. And every time I see that, I'm going, that would be him. And the weird thing was, having, you know, entered the race to create the profile that would be required to get that thing funded, then he ends up winning, which was not the expectation. So in other words, he's just going back to plan A. Now, why does he want to go back? Again, perception is everything. I or you might say that being president of the United States is the coolest, hottest, most important role you can play in the world. But his view could easily be, well, actually, now that I've been here, it's a nightmare. Being president, you're totally constrained. You know, you got legal constraints. You got institutional constraints. You know, in the first half of his term, he had a Republican Congress. Now he doesn't, so he's very limited on what he can get done on domestic stuff. Another reason he wants a victory on foreign policy where nobody can constrain him. He has freedom to act there that he doesn't have on domestic affairs. So I think also he's driven by another thing, which is the legal investigations, not the Mueller case, because the fact is, really, at the end of the day, the president can pardon everyone, including himself, in the Mueller case. There might be some legal challenges to that over time, but you could just basically make that announcement one afternoon and you're done. Mueller's over. But what you can't do is address the New York State prosecutor and the Manhattan Attorney General, both of whom are engaged in investigations into the Trump family affairs. And, you know, let's remember, it's not like you have to have a really serious case. You know, how do they get Al Capone? They got him on mail fraud. That means one time you misdated a check and you put it in a mail and you're done. That's an offense. So if you want to, if you've got to deal with that, that's all about you need money, because that's how you buy time in those cases. You've got to throw a whole lot of money at it. Well, one way that you solve all problems at once, you secure your place in history, you announce a much bigger platform than the White House, because TNN would definitely be that. It would have more echo chamber, more influence. He'd have less constraint, more freedom to tweet, you know, anything he wants. And that would also earn a ton of money. And so now you've solved all these problems. Because let's face it, is this president really going to just retire? I can't see it. He always has to go from one really big thing to a much bigger thing. And what is the bigger thing? It's TNN. And by the way, before anybody says, oh, you know, dismisses that, let's remember the last few presidents have all wanted to transition from being president of the United States into a global media brand. That's exactly what, for example, that's what the Clintons tried to do, right? Transition into a global brand that's visible through media. It's what the Obamas are currently doing, right? You do books and their public profile, world tours, and you have a voice then. Tony Blair, similar thing. This is not unknown. This is now a pathway that many former leaders want to trod. In fact, the only one who hasn't done this at all has been the president I worked for, George W. And George W. Bush went, you know what? When I'm done, I'm done. And I will go back to chopping wood and other things. And I'm not going to use my position to have influence in that way because I don't think it's right. And he has been remarkably quiet since leaving office and did not, you know, he's done a few speeches, but he didn't go off to try to be a voice on and to criticize his successors or things like that. So I think this is a real possibility. And I would go a step further and say, not only does he want to get this deal done with the Chinese, because that cements his place in history, he wants to be in a position to launch this thing immediately after leaving the White House, which to my mind raises questions about where would the financing come from. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see that ends up being, you know, sovereign wealth funds, certain nations, and that he'll probably announce this at the worst possible moment for the American political machine, right? Is he going to say to everybody, well, actually, I've decided I'm not going to run again. I'm going to launch TNN. I think you could expect that he might announce this weeks before the next American presidential election, throwing a spanner into the works, making everybody wrong-footed. The Democrats will all be positioned to fight on the, we hate Trump, vote for us to get rid of Trump, and suddenly he's not there. They're pushing against something that just disappeared. So they're all wrong-footed. And Republicans don't enter the race because it's hard to enter against an incumbent president. And then he steps to the side and goes, I'm leaving. And they'll go, wait, you know, wait. So and why would he do that? Because he is so angry with the American political machine and how badly he feels it's treated him. I could easily see that he would announce this right at the last minute. And by the way, what would that guarantee? Massive coverage of his new network, which I suspect will have everything from political talk shows to reality TV. And might I say, when I saw that Kanye was having meetings in the West Wing, I'm like, makes total sense if you're launching TNN. Total sense. So yes, that's the timing that I see.
Wow. So let me summarize this to make sure I got it straight. You're actually saying that you think President Trump ran for president of the United States not expecting to win, but with the goal of discrediting the mainstream media so that when he didn't win, he could say, look at what a mess this media thing was. I'm going to do a better job and create something else. To his own surprise, he wins the presidency.
Well, I think definitely he did it with the intention of, he didn't expect to win. I would stand by that. And everybody on his team knows they didn't expect to win. Nobody expected him to win. But did he do it with the intention of discrediting the media? No, I think he did it with the intention of, it was a great platform that gave him profile in his effort to create TNN.
Well, he was certainly vocal in expressing critical views of the mainstream media during his campaign. So it would fit that narrative. And then he ends up becoming president, decides, okay, let's solve the nuclear problem on the Korean Peninsula, get maybe not for himself, but for somebody a Nobel Prize that he gets some credit for. And then at the last minute, he says, you know what? The best thing I can do, people, for the country is, if you look at what's really going on here, the media is so corrupt that it's corrupted our entire political system. I'm a businessman. I'm going to step out of politics and go create the Trump News Network to bring you real news, according to him. And that happens at a very awkward moment that leaves everybody wrong-footed. And that means the next election could go in any direction. Did I really get all of that straight?
I would agree with all of that, with one exception, which is not I'm leaving the political stage. I am moving the political stage where I want it, which is not the Oval Office. And this thing that I'm creating will dwarf the powers of the Oval Office, because your ability to influence public opinion from a TNN platform is much bigger than your ability to influence it from the White House. So he will be remaining in politics. He's just saying, this platform is not as good as the one I'm about to create.
Wow. Let's move on to our next topic. China, I mean, how do you move on from that one? China and Russia and the alliance that seems to be forming there. Both militarily, it seems like they may even be collaborating on efforts to ditch the dollar in foreign trade, the de-dollarization initiative, and so forth. What do you think the big picture is? What's driving it? What are people missing from that story?
Oh, look, I think this has been around for a while. Bottom line is that the Russians, I think, are very nervous about China, because China's just so much bigger and has more resources and is slowly encroaching upon Russia, and the Russians can't really do anything about it. You know, you just have to look at the numbers, you know, how many Russians are in eastern Russia and along the border with China, you know, compared to the number of Chinese, they're just dwarfed. So what options do they have? Well, not many. The smart thing is for Russia to try to align itself with China. But I don't think that China views Russia as that important a partner. So it's more about what does China want than it is about what Russia wants. But there is an important thing developing, which is China and Russia and the United States are now understanding that conflict is not going to be occurring in traditional ways. It's basically happening in cyberland, that the new space race is in the cyber arena. And this is why all three have a space program, right? Because once you have a space program, what that's really all about is control over high altitude satellites, which is control over communications systems and networks. It's control over weapons systems. So we now are in a new space race, but it's not this get a man on the moon. You know, we've recently seen the Chinese, you know, land on the dark side of the moon. I think part of this is the military race for domination over the highest altitudes possible. They're also all in a race for computational power. And that means the ability to crunch all this data that everybody is gathering. And there's no doubt part of the new space race is for supercomputing and quantum computing. And we definitely have an incredible amount of state investment from all three of these entities going into supercomputers and quantum computers in the effort to have the fastest, most comprehensive number crunching capabilities. Because what does it buy you? It buys you the ability to break everybody else's codes, whether they're nuclear codes or personal passwords to your Pentagon laptop, or it's the password to your Bitcoin account. It's all about cracking the code. And I don't only mean codes in the conventional sense of a password, but also breaking the code of the population. So there's a company called SenseTime, which is the most valuable startup in the world today. It's worth about $6 billion, about to be worth $8 billion, I think. And what SenseTime can do, it's a Chinese company. It can identify, for example, the emotional state of a crowd of, well, it was 10,000, but it looks like they're getting close to being able to identify the emotional state of a crowd of 100,000 people. So you can begin to understand what's happening in a population. And it can also identify microfacial movements that indicate when someone is lying. You can imagine how valuable that is in any kind of negotiation process. So when I say breaking the code, it's also breaking the code of a population, understanding what's actually happening in the White House or with your forward troops somewhere, or any kind of information about logistics and the emotional topography of a population. And this is where all these nations are devoting more and more resources. This is the new defense spending, and it's the new quantitative easing. I mean, it's how governments are chucking an incredible amount of money into the world economy. The good news is the civilian spinoffs will be extraordinary. So it's better than spending it on new aircraft carriers. But at the same time, this is the stuff that gives us faster weapon systems. Now we're in the land of hypersonic weapons and things like that. So, yes, the China-Russia increased alliance, definitely it's a real thing. But I think it's much more driven by Chinese interests than by Russian interests. And definitely it's the new space race between the West and, if you want to lump Russia into the East, then it is that. Definitely it is that.
I want to touch on this question of what has changed in the public perception, or maybe it's the government communication priority. I'm not sure. But if I think back to the Cold War, all it would take would be for Russia to put a new paint job on one of their tanks. And, you know, that's newsworthy. It's something else to be afraid of. Oh, my gosh, the Russians, they're trying to get one up on us. As I understand the current situation, and I do not profess to be expert on this, but my understanding is that the newest generation of hypersonic missile systems, which Russia is known to have not just in development, but operational, ready for use right now, here and now today. China, I believe, is a little bit behind them, but close. There is no defense in the existing U.S. arsenal. It completely eliminates the defenses of our anti-missile systems because the things just are going too fast. Meanwhile, the U.S.'s ability to project force around the world is entirely based on its 10 aircraft carrier groups. And as I understand it, there are new hypersonic missiles that are designed specifically to be able to sink a U.S. aircraft carrier. And once again, there basically is no defense system because the defenses that are in place are not capable of defending against an incoming target that's moving at Mach 12 or whatever it is that these things travel at. I would think that would be newsworthy, Pippa, but you know, there's very few people that even know this is going on. What happened? Why is it not interesting?
I agree. People don't know. Well, and you're right. But so one solution, and I think it's the direction that all these nations are moving. One solution is you don't wait for the other side to launch a hypersonic weapon. What you do is build your offensive cyber capabilities in such a way that you understand their decision-making process and you can detect when they're moving in that direction before anybody actually hits a button. you actually already know what their launch codes are, and you intervene so that they can't be launched, right? In other words, warfare has entered the cyberspace in a way, because the kinetic weapons, you're right, they're just too fast to respond to. So a deeper understanding of what's the precursor to a button being pushed, that's where all the intelligence and focus and money is going. And the question is, will we be correct in our assessment or not? I mean, these days, if you recall, at one point, it was discovered that the Chinese had a very secret cyber command on a particular stretch of road in Shanghai. And how was it discovered? Because one of the Chinese employees, very senior level, stopped in the same Starbucks every day on his way into work. And what they call the side leakage of his mobile device gave away enough information that they were able to almost count the steps from the time he left the Starbucks till the time he got to his desk and started to launch cyber attacks, that they knew it was him. And therefore, that this was the building where all of this capability resided. And then it was made public that this is where this is. You know, this is kind of how we're conducting our new wars. It's not with kinetic weapons. It's in cyberspace. And honestly, to be fair, maybe that is a better way to conduct our conflicts, right? I mean, better not to use kinetic weapons. And instead, we have a whole bunch of skullduggery and cat and mouse going on in the cyber arena that the public isn't even aware of. Maybe that is a better way to have our competitions and our conflicts. If you can't eliminate them altogether, better to have them happen in this more limited arena. But then the big question becomes, okay, in cyber world, then what would be a truly catastrophic event? And the answer is, well, when you turn the whole electrical grid off, you know, it's infrastructure vulnerability. And this is a high, high, high priority for most militaries and governments around the world. And so, yeah, should the public be aware of this? I think yes. And you know, I've written about this. In the end, people are very focused on what's in it for me today. So unless there's a threat to them right now, then all of this is just like too dark a subject to bother with for the time being. So you and I can talk about it, but most people, they're just not that focused on all this.
Let's move on to another subject, actually two topics, which I believe are very closely related, although some people don't think so. One is the populism explosion that we're seeing in Europe with the Yellow Vest movement and so forth. And then in the United States, there's something that I think is related, but it comes in a different flavor, which is the growth of the Democratic Socialist Party, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Some people have even observed that if she were old enough to be eligible to run for president, she could probably get the nomination. This is the ex-bartender from New York who seems to be trying to outdo Bernie Sanders as a socialist. What's going on here? What's driving all of this, and where is it headed?
Well, I think there's a quite universal trend towards populism. People keep thinking it's local and it's specific. Brexit is specific to Britain. You know, even the election of Donald Trump is a very narrow, specific set of forces. I disagree. I think that it's a much more generalized phenomena, and it represents a breakdown of trust and confidence in the traditional institutions of power and the people who've been working in them. So, for example, in this last congressional race that brought Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to power, I think it's something like nearly one-third of the new members in the House have not worked in politics. Like, they are genuinely from outside the system. And I think the American public in particular has wanted outsiders. In Britain, we're seeing a similar thing where people are kind of getting fed up with the traditional party politics and leaving to form new parties, and suddenly traditional alignments are not reliable anymore. The same is happening across Europe. People are saying, I'm frustrated with the traditional approach and I'm looking for new ideas, new leadership. And so this underpins populism all over the world. I personally always take it back to the debt. It's the burden of debt bearing down on all these societies and making everybody realize that we can't afford to meet everybody's needs. The minute you realize there's not enough money to go around, then you start to say, hey, how come their interests are being met but not mine? And the moment you say that, the next question is, and why are you guys in charge? That's the question of populism. Why are you in charge? And we are seeing everywhere a desire for new leadership. And this was, you know, very much subject of my last book on leadership called The Leadership Lab, was today's leaders are not understanding that this desire for somebody outside the system is so powerful, because their view is, but I have the skill. I have worked in this leadership role for many years, therefore I know. But in fact, what we see is the public want outsiders. And that's why I also would say the next American presidential race is going to be so interesting, because even if I'm wrong and Trump remains in the race, I think he is going to face competition from other Republicans. I think there's various groups forming to challenge him from the Republican side. And from the Democrat side, we Democrats are challenging the central tenets of the Democratic Party. The Bernie Sanders and the Ocasio-Cortez camp are challenging the traditional Clintonian view, which is, you know, Democrats are fairly conservative on economic policy, liberal on social policy, but not to the extreme. They're going, forget that. We want a whole new system, which is much more like France. It's a rejection of capitalism and the embracing of what Americans traditionally called socialism. In Britain, we're seeing exactly the same thing, but in the opposite direction. Actually, Israel as well, where you start to see the right, the far right, becoming attractive to certain members of the population, as they say, the mainstream is not serving our interests. Let's go further out the curve. So I think it's in both directions. We're becoming more extreme, both to the left and the right. And what I think might actually work is the centrists, if they can come up with a compelling story. And that's why one combination that I'm keeping an eye on, someone like Mike Bloomberg, if he were to actually commit and enter the race, he's exactly the kind of candidate that people want. A successful business guy. He's quite bipartisan. He's not ideological, quite progressive, conservative, but not hard Christian. And I think there's a market for that in this new environment. Is there a market for the Bernie Sanders end of the spectrum? Yes, but I'm still not sure that the American public is ready to say, let's move to a world at a 80% tax rate. I just don't see the United States actually being in that position. But I think this is a fascinating moment in history, because the capacity for the public to realign around extremes and then leave space in the center for candidates that have the real possibility of bringing everybody back into the middle. I think that's where we potentially go next.
Just a quick note for our listeners, since you mentioned your outstanding book, Leadership Lab. You didn't mention it, but your prior book, Signals, was also excellent. We've done interviews with Pippa on both of those books. Just go to macrovoices.com, type Pippa in the search box, and you'll find those past interviews, which are as relevant today as the day that they were recorded. Moving along, coming back to this shift in capitalism, there's another trend that I know you've talked and written about, which is the move from capitalism to so-called surveillance capitalism. What does that mean, and what are the consequences?
So there's a new book out by a Harvard Business School professor called Shoshana Zuboff called Surveillance Capitalism. And it's getting a lot of traction. And I think it's one of those must reads, because what she does is to explain this new environment where basically data is being gathered about you all the time, whether it's a camera that you pass at a shopping mall, capturing your face and your emotional state as you walk by, or the chips that are in your clothes or your shoes, the information that your mobile device is giving off about you. Like, you know, even if you don't have the Google location finder on, you turned it off, it's still tracking your location. Or Facebook, they have apps, and the fact is you may not use them, but they're still tracking how you walk. And how you walk reveals a huge amount about the condition of your heart, your general health. And we're moving into an environment where your identifier, right? In the past, how did you identify yourself? Because you signed and it was your signature. Then maybe it was your thumbprint. Now we're in a world where it's your behavior. So the Pentagon has just made a big investment in, I'm trying to remember the name of the company, that is making building passes, right? So your pass to get in and out of the Pentagon based on your overall behaviors. So if you go to a certain grocery store every week on a Thursday, and then for a couple of weeks you don't go there, you go to a grocery store clear on the other side of town, it's going to clock that your behavior has been disrupted and therefore challenge as you enter the building to say, is it really you? In other words, where you go, how you walk, the tone of your voice, who are you talking to? All these things get picked up to create a biometric picture of your behavior. And that behavior is known to the internet, right? It's known to whoever owns all those silos of data. And let's face it, the purpose of artificial intelligence is to connect the dots in all those different silos to create a comprehensive picture. And what really matters is, first of all, this changes the balance of power between states and citizens, between companies and customers, because the company knows much more about you than you even know about yourself. I mean, I was talking with someone who runs a luxury goods firm the other day. They said, oh, yes, we're using all this already, and we have customers. We know who they are the moment they walk into the shop because they have facial recognition, and we see this as a customer. They will tell you, if you ask them, I am here to buy a handbag. But we already know they're not. They're going to buy earrings because the data we have about them tells us they're going to buy earrings. And they will deny it. They'll be like, no, 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 I'm here to buy a handbag. But what do they walk out of the store with? Earrings. So this is the thing. What does this mean for capitalism? It means, by the way, I think we've had insider trading laws. If you know this inside information about a company, you're not allowed to profit from that. I think we might need insider trading laws. If my level of insight into your life, your emotional state of being, it's so deep that I can basically sell you anything, right? If I know that you're at home on a Friday night, but you'd rather be out and your dating apps are not working for you, this is the perfect time to be selling you ice cream. Right? So this type of thing, it changes the nature of capitalism. And frankly, there's a question of how much personal freedom does a human being require to really be human? Like, what is it to be human? And I like what Frank Zappa said, which is progress comes from deviating from the norm. And so if you don't allow people to deviate from the norm, you're not going to get progress. And I think the Chinese are going down this road more forcefully than anyone else with their social credit system, where they actually give every citizen a score, like an Uber score, based on their social behaviors. And I just don't know, how do you say to all these people, I want you to behave in this very narrow, limited way and not look at pornography and not behave badly. Don't leave your bicycle on the footpath, because all these things will reduce your score. But when you go to work, I want you to just let the creativity rip. You have to give humans latitude to test the boundaries of life in lots of different ways. And I think this will prove to be our great strength in the West. And this is one reason that we need to keep an eye on how much the surveillance capitalism is being introduced, because we don't want to cause humans to start being fearful to Google something on the internet because it might affect whether they can enter the building they work in, because it might be considered not appropriate social behavior. And I don't mean just looking up, say, pornography or something. I mean, maybe you start looking at a Twitter feed that is deemed to be too far to the left or too far to the right from what your employer thinks is appropriate. and suddenly you become a question mark as an employee. This is a really important development, and I don't think people are sufficiently aware of how deep this is. So that's my point about surveillance capitalism.
Help me understand what changed in human behavior. Because if we go back to June of 1949, when the book 1984 by George Orwell was first published, it was extremely controversial. And first of all, people said, well, the technology is never going to happen. But even if it did, there's no way that the American people would ever remotely begin to submit to that kind of surveillance and control. Now, when I forget which model of iPhone it was, 8 or 10 or something, there was one model recently where it was very widely publicized that this new phone has camera technology, which a lot of people thought was put there so that Apple would be able to collect basically the level of detail about your face that would make you recognizable to facial recognition systems for the rest of your life. And everybody knew that that feature was in there. People who were hoping to kill the launch of that product were publicizing it, and they were lined up, Pippa, around the corner, sleeping in sleeping bags, waiting for the Apple store to open so they could buy one. What happened that people went in 1949 from there's no way we would ever allow ourselves to be surveilled that way to we can't wait to get the next thing from Facebook?
I know, it's so interesting. And by the way, it continues. The new phones are now all going to have triple rear cameras. And those triple rear cameras are even better than a single to capture the environment, your emotional expressions. You know, at Apple, every time you open your phone, you have to look at it. It's not that it's just identifying your face. What it's learning is all your emotional reactions. What's your state of mind? And if you combine that with voice, then you start to understand what's the person's frame of mind at this particular moment that I'm trying to interface with them. That's why I think Google recently announced in their Nest device that, yes, it does have a voice recorder, and they thought everybody knew that, and it turns out people were surprised. But nobody should be surprised. Everything now, from your refrigerator, your trash can, literally, your sneakers, like every single thing will have sensors, cameras, and all of it's aimed at capturing your emotional state, your physical location. You know, even your phone has a barometric device that tells them you were on the 15th floor of the building, not the 16th floor of the building. And how is it that they've sold it to the public? Because it's fun. Because it's fun. And to be honest, it is fun. I mean, these devices bring us incredible amounts of fun and productivity, and we're able to run our lives in much better ways, smarter. I mean, I run my business off my phone. So I'm not saying that we should get rid of all the tech. I'm just saying one thing to be aware of is technology is always a double-edged sword. And the double-edged sword is a good analogy. There's a wonderful book called The Axe Maker's Gift, which came out years ago. It might have been even the late 80s, but very clever book about how technology always cuts both ways. You get incredible advances and big, big problems. They happen simultaneously. So I'm just saying this next iteration of technology, it's absolutely turbocharging our lives in ways that I see huge economies unfolding that everybody's going to be able to engage in. I see democratization of technology. People will be able to make a living doing all kinds of great, interesting, cool things in future. But there's also this other side, which is this lockdown on the behavior of individuals. And I'm asking questions about, is that what we want? Should we be trying to do something about what it means for the balance of power in the society? Do we need to think about, are there places that people should be able to go without being watched all the time? You know, is this really like only a system the Stasi could dream of, but somehow has become reality? I just think these are important social and philosophical questions. And so I'm not anti-tech, not at all. But I do think there are lots of philosophical and practical issues that deserve our attention. And there are a lot of people writing about this more and more. I think that the tech community, too, is recognizing the benefit of having all this information about you may be offset by some of the negative aspects of someone having all this information about you.
Let's tie all of this together to what it means for markets, which, of course, interests our investor audience. The whole Trump-Xi thing, China-Russia alliance, presidential race, populism, what does this lead you to in terms of a conclusion of where we're headed? Because a whole lot of people think that we are overdue for some kind of market crash here. Do you share that view?
I don't. And I don't remember when we did our last interview together, but it was some months ago. And I remember saying at that time, I was very optimistic about markets and the global economy. Now, we did have a pullback, and you could say it was a significant pullback, right? I think you said we looked at a 20% correction, but we've recovered it all. And it happened so fast, you almost missed it if you blinked. And I think this is very important, is actually the underpinnings for a melt up are so much stronger than the probabilities of a meltdown. And even when the market gets itself super negative and it finds every darn thing that it could be upset about, it goes down, but not for very long. And so what do I see? I see investors all over the world, particularly large institutional investors, they have a lot of dry powder. They want to put their capital to work. They are no longer just doing share buybacks. They're actually looking to invest in the real economy. There is a place for them to invest because the technological innovation revolution that we're in is epic. And I know that from being in it myself with my robotics company as a manufacturer. I can see you no longer need to have like a huge lab and thousands of employees to create and innovate. A handful, a couple of people with an iPhone can build world-class stuff. You don't need much capital. It's just a totally different economy of scale environment that this technological revolution has ushered in. I also see governments are spending. They're just not spending on QE. They're spending it on the defense sector and cyber. I see that as being highly investable, not in terms of buying defense stocks, though it's really interesting to see what's happening to defense stock prices. But it is in terms of what are all these technologies and what are the spin-offs into the real economy? And I'd say they're huge. I see a world where China is building the Belt and Road Initiative and creating much better quality infrastructure, which the whole world can benefit from. And will that lift many emerging markets? I'd say yes, it definitely will. So I think my personal view is what I hear from investors all over the world, whether they're retail or institutional, they're all preparing for a meltdown, and they're completely and utterly unprepared for the possibility that they're wrong, and it's a melt-up for the next decade that's going to dominate that landscape. And I just ask, why is it that we have so much certainty when everybody's been blindsided so consistently over certainly the last decade? How is it you can be so sure that Brexit would never happen, that Trump would never win, that China wouldn't slow down? And then all these things have happened, and now you go, but I'm sure that the markets are going to melt down, and I'm going to build my future on that. What about the possibility that it isn't binary, first of all, that there's an array of possible outcomes, and we should consider that there's a possibility that some of those outcomes might be really, really good? I mean, again, the Industrial Revolution, that was an amazing period of history. But if I compare to the level of innovation now, I'd say it's much bigger. I think it's a much bigger risk that we sit in our armchairs afraid and miss this thing than that we dive in and we get a meltdown. Because even if we get a meltdown, they don't last very long. There's just too much money and too much innovation for the whole thing to stop.
Pippa, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. We're going to have to leave it here in the interest of time. Before we go, though, I never know how to do this with you, because are you Pippa Malmgren, geopolitical consultant? Are you Pippa Malmgren, award-winning author? You've got two recent books out, Signals and Leadership Lab. Rumor has it, the rumor mill says that Leadership Lab may be under consideration for Business Book of the Year. I guess it's a little bit early to congratulate you on that one, if that's coming. Meanwhile, that's not even your day job. You also run H Robotics. Why don't you tell us a little bit, very briefly, about what the books are about and what H Robotics does?
Yeah, so, you know, I always say I'm an economist. I just express it in a lot of different ways. So the books are about how I see the world unfolding. And this Leadership Lab, yeah, I just got shortlisted for this Business Book of the Year award. I'll find out next month, which will be exciting. But really, that book's about the diversity of thinking that is required to manage in today's complex environment and trying to help people who have been trained to be analytical to learn how to be more parenthetical. And by that, I mean they're super good at the drill down into ever deeper mathematical detail. They're not great at the look across the landscape, at understanding the zeitgeist. They can measure the numbers and then the math, but they just have no sense of the mood. And so they just miss what's happening out there. And so that was my focus for that book. But H Robotics, really, that's my main enterprise, my main focus. It's frankly the best thing I've ever done. It was a personal bet. I just decided after the bailout, I was like, you know what? We're going to have at least a decade of amazing growth and probably more. $20 trillion, that lasts a long time. And if I really believe that, I should be part of building the world economy. And I've had a particular view about robotics and automation. And basically what we're manufacturing is we make commercial drones for industrial use. But really what it's about is data gathering. So the surveillance capitalism that I talk about, I'm very much part of it, except my focus is on gathering data for the purposes of helping businesses run better. So that, I don't know if you heard about this terrible dam collapse they had in Brazil a few months ago, which killed so many people at a mining site. You know, my robotics get used to prevent that from happening so that you can see when there's a problem with the tailings dam. And I'm in favor of preventing those kinds of crises and that sort of unnecessary loss of life. And it lets me be at the cutting edge of what all the new devices and sensors and technology is, and then manage the data process, which is how companies get to actually see what's happening to their assets all over the world. So that's my principal focus, but it's sure been useful, to say the least, in informing my understanding as an economist of what's really going on out there.
Well, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview, and we look forward to having you back soon. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Pippa back on the show. You know, she had great political insights, but really what I wanted to just touch on was right at the end of the interview when you started talking the equity markets. And I understand when someone in her position is looking at equity markets from a entrepreneurial perspective or from innovation, there's a lot of really fascinating things to look forward to in the future. But, you know, I still find it really hard to kind of take on that bull case of putting that perspective that in spite of the traditional business cycle that plays out, the monetary cycle and the tightening cycle that we've seen, the fact that the central bank or the Fed has been shrinking its balance sheet and raising interest rates, all of these things typically precede some form of an economic slowdown. While that slowdown doesn't have to be a doomsday-ish bear market that, you know, is a repeat of 2007, 2008, but I still believe that business cycles exist and that in some form or another, we're at the tail end of one of these. You know, what's your take on that?
Well, Patrick, you know, I think you're alluding to a really, really important point that is just so important, not just for those of us that work in financial markets, but for society as a whole. We got to get to the bottom of something. And that something is this idea that central bankers are able to seemingly defy gravity and use money conjured out of thin air to rescue markets without there being any adverse consequence. Now, if this is really true, as some people are saying, they think that Ben Bernanke is an absolute genius who deserves a Nobel Prize and that this has been a grand success and everything's great. Other people are saying, look, there's no free lunch. The piper has to be paid eventually. There's going to be an adverse consequence to all of this central bank largesse. Now, I have subscribed to the latter view. I think that there is no free lunch. I think we're going to pay a price for all of this printed money. But hey, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, how long could it last? I would have said 5 years at the absolute outside. It's been twice that long now, and we really haven't seen any major adverse consequence to aggressive, coordinated central bank accommodative monetary policy. If this really works, if modern monetary theory is truly right and there's just no problem with deficits, for heaven's sakes, why don't we stimulate the economy, Patrick, by permanently getting rid of taxes and print money and solve all of our problems that way if there's no consequence? I don't think there is no consequence. What remains to be seen is what form it comes in and how it plays out. I still think it's coming, but I didn't think we could go this long without feeling it. At some point, we've got to get to the bottom of that.
Now, I did have to ask you here, Eric, what did you think of her view that Trump never originally planned to win?
Well, I don't have anywhere close to enough political knowledge myself to even have an opinion on whether something like that could be true. But I'll tell you what really resonated for me in that conversation is who's really the most important powerful person in the world? Is it the President of the United States, or is it the person who is at the helm in charge of the biggest media organization that shapes popular opinion? Because one thing that's become just profoundly clear to me in recent years is we don't have news anymore. We have perspective. We have opinion where literally so-called news channels are created to appeal to people with a particular bias and a particular political leaning. So we've got left-wing news channels and we've got right-wing news channels. And if you were to objectively look at the so-called news that they're reporting, you'd almost think that they're reporting events that happened on two different planets with a different perspective. You know, the whole idea of journalism is journalists are supposed to have the discipline to never allow their own views to influence reporting the facts, ma'am, just the facts and nothing but the facts. When's the last time you saw a commentary on a news channel that was just the facts? And I don't know whether or not Pippa's speculation about President Trump's motivations could be right or not, but I certainly do think that he who is the President of the United States and he who is Rupert Murdoch or otherwise in charge of the biggest media organizations, it's a real question in my mind as to which one has more power and influence over the world.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Eric. You know, it's really going to be interesting as we approach 2020 and all of these people that are just kind of throwing their hat in the ring. When it all starts to develop, it's going to be one of the most interesting political elections, as interesting at least as 2016.
Well, it sure will be. It'll be interesting to see. Meanwhile, folks, we need your help promoting Macro Voices. Please tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices. Help us get the word out, because the more registered users we have, the more we're able to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. In case you haven't noticed Patrick's outstanding efforts year to date, we're really getting some fantastic guests on the program, and we need your help to get more. So please help us to spread the word about Macro Voices, and most importantly, Register your free account at macrovoices.com. Only takes a few minutes. Don't be afraid to send us a donation if you appreciate Macro Voices to help us with our production costs. And the benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email every week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including supporting materials for our feature interviews. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
On this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. You'll also find an article from Nick Cunningham on shale growth is nearing an inflection point. I also include an article from Jeffrey Snyder on Jay Powell is in the way, literally on the U.S. Treasury curve. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSeresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Seresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.